So our next speaker also works in the US government, but he works in a different branch. He's the director of IARPA and has worked his way up through the organization. I'm totally going to mess up what IARPA stands for, the Intelligence Advanced Research Priorities Activities. Close. Project Activities. Excuse me. IARPA works on a variety of really interesting research projects, some having to do with prediction, other things in the assistance of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. As we heard from Tom Khalil, they often work in collaboration with other organizations and fund interesting projects from collaborators who are trying to help the US government improve its own intelligence capacities and be at the cutting edge of research. I'll let him introduce his work a little bit more, but Jason Matheny.
Thanks. So Tom talked about many of the great ways of working in government to be engaged in advancing science and technology. I'll talk about a few different ways within government to advance technology development. And I want to first I'll talk a little bit about how I became involved in government working on technology. I'll then sort of argue for the proposition that developing technologies or affecting the rate of technology development is one way to substantially affect good in the world. And then I'll argue for a second proposition, which is that one way to substantially affect the rate of technology development is to work in a variety of different roles in government. So first, when I started out my career, I worked in public health and sort of traditional infectious disease control, epidemiology, cost-effectiveness analysis of things like new drugs and vaccines against malaria and tuberculosis and HIV, really found that that work and continue to find that work of critical importance to determining sort of long-term welfare on the planet. So I think that as sort of a area of endeavor is one that I continue to think is really important. I know a lot of you all are involved in that kind of work. In about 2002, there was a set of discoveries relating to how to build a virus from scratch without requiring that you find a example of the virus already. The technology that was being developed that we now call synthetic biology was making it possible to take the chemical constituents of a virus and create a new virus in the same way that one might create a piece of computer software. And a number of us who had worked on infectious disease control, going as far back, say, as the eradication campaigns for smallpox, saw this as really a landmark because it meant that some of the diseases that we had to worry about would be diseases that we had previously eradicated, but now it was possible to reconstruct, or diseases that we had had no prior experience with because they were truly novel and possibly much worse than their natural variants. So it was at that time that I moved from traditional public health work to work in national security and national intelligence. And I think one of the things that I've appreciated about working in this community is that there's a sense both about the opportunities and the risks for many emerging technologies. So one of the things I want to argue for is that For those of you who are interested in careers of effective altruism, I think there's a lot of gains to be made from looking at technology development as a driver of progress globally, and also as a potential risk that will require management and careful thought. We have, on the positive side, examples of technologies like sanitation, antibiotics, vaccines, the development of dwarf strains of wheat or of synthetic fertilizers that collectively have saved over 1 billion lives in the last century. I mean, these are some of the highest leverage investments that society has made, and the benefits from those really do sort of register in the billions. And you can look at individual technology developments that have had a massive impact on welfare in the globe. So to take as one example, Norman Borlaug's development of dwarf strains of wheat in the 1950s, that alone is credited with saving hundreds of millions of lives. And in one instance of its introduction in South Asia during the 1960s, probably saved over 50 million lives over a 5-year period. So if you think about what we gained from the development of that technology, but just as importantly, what we would have lost had that technology been delayed, we are talking in the tens of millions of lives just due to the possible delay of a technology's introduction. That's the kind of direct impact that technology development can have on welfare. There, I think, is an equally important indirect impact of technology on welfare, which is the effect that technology has on moral progress by reducing the cost of adopting certain kinds of ethical norms. So to give one example, in the 18th and 19th centuries, the introduction of mechanization made it possible for an ever larger number of people to become abolitionists and to adopt the view of abolition as a moral stance, because the cost of doing so was much diminished. As another example, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the reduced cost of food preparation and food preservation meant that half of humanity no longer needed to be confined to domestic services, which then enabled an increasing part of society to adopt a moral stance about gender equality. So these are historical cases of technologies in a way enabling moral progress by decreasing the cost of acting on our best moral impulses. And I think we can see current examples today. For instance, if we develop a cost-effective and convincing substitute for meat, that would allow an ever larger fraction of people to bring in line their diets with their moral impulses. So this is an indirect effect of technology, is to make it less costly to act on those moral impulses. And together, those direct effects of technology and those indirect effects of technology, I think, represent substantial positive aspects of the development and acceleration of technology. There's also the negative effects of technology development. And some of you who are focused on catastrophic risks or existential risks, I think there's an argument to be made for why that's a really important set of issues for effective altruists, because there's so much value potentially in our future that ensuring that we have a future counts for a lot. It has a lot of expected value. Most of the high probability existential risks appear to be technological in nature. So we do have natural hazards, asteroid impacts, supervolcanoes, nearby supernova or gamma ray bursts. Those sorts of events, though, have annual probabilities less than 1 in 1 million. It seems like the anthropogenic technological risks have higher probability than 1 in 1 million per year, whether that's nuclear war or biological warfare or cyber warfare. So dealing with these technological threats requires that we both make wise choices as a society about what kinds of technologies to accelerate, but also what kinds of technologies to decelerate or to invest in differentially. So differential technology development could include increasing the investments in defensive technologies while you're at the same time trying to decrease investments in offensive technologies. And for most technological risks, like nuclear weapons or biological weapons or cyber weapons, the defenses do require new technology development. For example, our main defenses against novel biological threats are the development of things like broad-spectrum antibiotics or vaccines or better diagnostics or new approaches to detecting disease outbreaks much earlier than traditional methods. As another example, there's been, I know, much discussion this weekend about some of the potential risks from advances in artificial intelligence, and it seems like many of the most promising routes to approaches to AI safety involve investing in technologies and verification and validation of autonomous systems. So I think that any sort of balanced portfolio of technology investment that's meant to accelerate on balance human progress is going to require investments in defensive technologies. And that's really, I think, at the crux of my argument for why technology development is so central to improving welfare. But there's another proposition that I have, which is that an effective way to affect the development of technologies is to work in government. Tom Khalil is one example of somebody who has spent much of his career influencing to the public's good a range of science and technology efforts, coordinating them in a way such that they're more cost-effective and picking the hardest problems in science and technology that can contribute most to public welfare. Now, clearly, there are lots of places to affect technology development. For instance, one could work directly on inventing new technologies. You could work in industry. You could work in academia. You could work in a government lab. You could fund the development of technologies. You could work for a venture capital firm. You could work as a manager in an industry organization that has a large research budget. You could work in a government organization like mine. Or you could become rich and fund it yourself. You could also work on science and technology policy at the higher level, as Tom does, in being able to shape the priorities for national investment. And that affects not only the funding of research, but also the kind of attention that it receives from various stakeholders. You could also work at a think tank that influences the direction of science policy, and you could work as a science journalist or a science communicator who helps to bring attention to some technologies. It's not an exhaustive list, and I think clearly there are a range of ways in which, as individuals or groups, we can influence the direction of technology. So I don't know enough to argue that one is better than another, but I'll argue that you can have a substantial impact by working in government funding organizations. And I'll give two examples. So one is to work in a funding organization directly, like, say, the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation or one of the ARPAs, like the Intelligence ARPA where I sit, the Defense ARPA, Homeland Security ARPA, or the ARPA for Energy. At those organizations, an individual government manager can personally direct tens of millions of dollars per year into research projects that otherwise wouldn't occur. So the counterfactual is this work really doesn't happen unless that program manager decides this is going to be a priority for investment. It's possible, but I think very difficult, to earn that much money to give. When I thought about how to do good in the world, I thought about, well, should I try to become, you know, an investment banker and earn that much to give? And at least my own assessment of my own skills and likelihood of sort of achieving tens of millions of dollars per year in income in order to donate made me less optimistic about that than the other option of working on the funding side to direct research dollars to places where it could do the most good. So that's why I came to IARPA. It was the prospect of having a multiplier effect on my own research effort to be able to fund hundreds or thousands of researchers smarter than I am to work on the problems that I think are most important. And a couple of examples of the sort of work that we funded that I think touches on the kinds of problems that have been discussed this weekend. IARPA collaborates with Microsoft Research in funding a new kind of mosquito trap, a smart mosquito trap that traps mosquitoes of specific species based on their wing beat frequency, and mosquitoes that have already obtained blood meal so that they can then be sampled for what kinds of diseases they're carrying. And this mosquito trap is now being deployed in Florida and Texas for monitoring Zika. It's also been deployed overseas. Now, the goal for a place like IARPA is to be able to detect disease outbreaks at the earliest possible moment so that our own public health facilities can be prepared for an outbreak. But you can think in more general terms about what's the value of having earlier detection mechanisms for diseases, the ability to develop vaccines sooner, the ability to mobilize antivirals. So this is, I think, one example of the way in which a research project can be accelerated to public benefit. Another example is work that we do in two programs run by Christy DeWitt at IARPA to develop new tools for detecting trace amounts of nuclear isotopes or chemical weapons remotely. And that kind of work then helps with our non-proliferation efforts to try to detect nuclear weapons development or chemical weapons development. A third area is a program called FungiCat, run by John Julius, which is looking at new methods to screen orders for commercial DNA synthesis. Right now, there's only voluntary screening by companies that produce DNA at scale. So the goal of this program is to screen DNA orders not only for existing pathogens, but also for novel pathogens. You heard possibly on Friday Phil Tetlock's talk about the ACE program, which was work that IARPA funded, running a large geopolitical forecasting tournament. And there's a panel later in the day on forecasting and some of its benefits. From that program, we were able to gain a lot of insight about the promise and peril of various forms of forecasting disease outbreaks, forecasting macroeconomic events, foreign elections, political instability, interstate conflict. And that puts society in a better position to understand where it can be confident about certain kinds of predictions and where it must remain humble and most resilient to uncertainty. So that's an example, I think, of work that can be done on the funding side. The other example, though, is to do work on the policy side. And I think what Tom Khalil has done at OSTP is the sort of model for the kind of career that one would like to have in science policy. So for those of you who are policy inclined and also have a STEM background or a STEM interest, my advice would be try to become Tom Khalil. I mean, Tom has, cumulatively affected where billions of dollars have gone in federal research investment and has really built coalitions across agencies that allow that money to be spent cost-effectively on some of society's most pressing challenges. So one way to have a significant impact as an effective altruist is to pursue that kind of path in science policy. In a way to close, in looking at this room, I sort of see like how many of you all are sort of early on in your careers, and I both am extremely hopeful and then also envious because I came at this sort of topic of thinking about how to do the most good, most efficiently, fairly late in my career. You all are very early. So you have an opportunity to do decades of high-impact work that benefits the globe. So my gratitude to you, and I hope I can answer any questions about how to pursue technology development in government. Okay, so Roxanne told me there's an app, which I'm going to now. Okay, so one question is, how do you predict and measure the impact of IARPA projects? So IARPA, when we have a large amount of intestinal fortitude, we sometimes think about applying prediction markets to our own projects. And sort of evaluating what's the probability that a given project will succeed or fail. We haven't done that yet. We only sort of fantasize about doing it. But one thing that we do is when we launch a program, we ask the program manager for their own probability of success, and we keep reevaluating that as the project continues. We also have external panels that we bring together. But we need to do more, I think, in sort of forecasting our own efforts. Following our own best prescriptions. The way of measuring the impact of IARPA projects is that we look at how the technologies are actually used, and then we get a lot of reports from the kind of effect that the use of that technology had on a particular mission. Because it's national intelligence, we're not often allowed to say a lot about how a technology made an impact. I can say we've funded technologies that have had a big impact on early detection of Ebola in West Africa. We've had successes in deploying technologies that have substantially increased our ability to counter ISIS overseas. And we've developed technologies that I think are really making breakthroughs in our ability to understand how the human brain operates at a nanometer scale up to a micron scale, as well as advances in fundamentals of computing. Another question here is, how do we make sure that government-driven science and technology is friendly? And I think this is the importance of pursuing roles in government science and technology is so that people like you who have a commitment to making the world better are helping to inform those decisions about what sort of research is funded. One thing I've been very impressed by in my work in government is by the moral impulses of my colleagues. But we need more people who care about making the world better in all of our institutions. One question, has there been anything you funded that you've regretted funding at IARPA? There are programs that have failed, that is, they technically didn't meet their goals. There are few projects that I have sort of moral uneasiness about, because our programs are evaluated as concepts before they're launched. They're evaluated in terms of what kind of impact will it have on civil liberties and privacy, what kind of impact will it have on human health, what kind of impact will it have on national security and public safety. So I feel very good about that progress. I think the kind of thing that I feel most uneasy about is should we have been doing more on areas that we might have neglected? And I think biology is one area where we're really trying to catch up. I think we're about a decade behind where we'd like to be in terms of biosecurity technologies. One question is, applying for IARPA grants currently requires a big time investment, often with a low probability of success. Are there any plans to lower the cost of such applications or to make the process more predictable? So one thing that we're increasingly making use of, and thanks in large part to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, is prize-driven challenges. So not requiring that somebody write a grant application in order to be paid for a solution to a pressing problem. So we run challenges in which we post an open problem. Anybody can compete for a prize, a dollar prize, in solving that challenge. Some of them are machine learning challenges. Some of them are challenges related, for instance, to developing high-resolution 3D maps of geospatial imagery. So how can you avoid the sort of melted chocolate views that you get in say, Google Earth, and in fact get fairly crisp representations of the Earth? We have an open challenge on that topic right now, and we have several others that we're going to be announcing before the end of the year. One question is, collaboration is hard. How does IARPA streamline collaboration with so many different players, and what are some best practices? We collaborate with over 50 different government organizations, and then multiple NGOs and companies and universities and colleges. That collaboration, we haven't found any shortcuts apart from the sorts of things that humans have been doing for millennia, which is meeting and coming to agreement, or at least identifying areas of disagreement. So for most of our projects, collaboration requires an awful lot of communication. And as much as we would like for Skype or video conferencing to replace travels from Maryland to Virginia and back, for the most part, most of our collaborations require lots of in-person meetings. I think I have time for one more question. How has your previous work affected how you think about your work at IARPA? Because I had more of a traditional public health background, I think I came into this work looking for opportunities for national intelligence to benefit public health broadly. Given the number of things that we work on, though, in national intelligence beyond health, it's made me concerned about a variety of emerging technologies, not just biotechnology, but also optimistic about the opportunities that we have to substantially advance welfare by making the right kinds of bets in technologies that can truly advance prosperity. I think one of the goals that the effective altruist movement has that I feel a lot of affiliation with is doing that sort of careful risk analysis and cost-effectiveness analysis of lots of options. When I look back at the career that I've had, I think there were lots of competing job opportunities that I thought about pursuing. But IARPA for me was a good pick because it really did allow me to fund so many bright researchers throughout academia and industry to work on the same kinds of problems that I was working on myself. And with that, I think we're done. Thank you.